The 1994 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 300, Readings from Mormon Women, by Maureen Erschenbach Beecher.
Thank you. Good morning. It's wonderful to see you here. I'd like to introduce our musicians. They're Sunstone babies, both of them. One of them is my daughter, Bronwyn Beecher, and the other one is Emily Adams, who is Connie Disney's daughter. Connie was the designer of the first Sunstone t-shirt. So we're very pleased to have them both here. When life seems complicated, and when the church seems part of that complication, I turn to my favorite women in all the world, the ones who left their diaries, autobiographies, and letters of the 19th century. And I think, and this is a pastoral fallacy, I think life must have been easier for them. It must have been easier for them to be Mormons in those days. And the reality, of course, is that it was not. And it never has been. And it never will be, nor should it be. But I find in their readings a spirit that sometimes I think I let fall. I let it lapse. I let it fall. So let me just spend the time this morning reading from some of those women of our Mormon past. This one is a young woman, Lucy Walker, who became known as Lucy Walker Kimball. And this is from an autobiography that she wrote later in her life. She talks about the spring of 1841. Father took his family to Nauvoo, and how her brother met them there with an invitation to dinner rendered by the Prophet Joseph and his wife Emma, and how the family became very fond of the children as well as of the parents. But during that summer of 1841, Lucy writes, Mother was taken very sick with chills and fever. At length, one after another was attacked with the same disease until we were all in a helpless condition. Mother was urged to spend a few days at the Prophet's house, they believing a change would benefit her. But she could not be content away from her afflicted family. At her earnest solicitation, they sent her home to her family. Those of you who are mothers recognize that feeling, that you simply cannot be away. Placing a bed and a sleigh, as the summer had passed and it was now good sleighing, covered her closely with blankets, and besides sent many comforts to those at home, as they had often during her stay there. Mother lingered until January 1842 and then passed away. Then Lucy gives her mother's words as she lay dying. Calling her children around her bed, she bore a faithful testimony as to her convictions that Joseph Smith was a prophet of God, and that through him the gospel of the Son of God had been restored in its fullness, whereby we might, through faithfulness, return to the presence of the Father. She earnestly exhorted her children to never depart from the truth, but live so that she might meet them in that world where there will be no more suffering, no more tears of anguish at pronouncing the sad word, goodbye. That's in a long tradition of women and men in their diaries and autobiographies, writing a testimony to their children. In this case, it was the daughter remembering the mother's testimony, which impressed me. Another woman, one that I had reason to research because of her involvement in the first Relief Society meeting in 1842, was Desdemona Fulmer. Text, I love the misspellings, and I wish you could read it with me. History is spelled H-I-S-T-E-R-Y. Particular is spelled P-A-R-T-I-C-U-L-E-R. Some is spelled S-O-M. Goodly is spelled G-O-D-L-E-Y, which I think in this context is as it should be. Strictly is spelled S-T-R-I-C-K-L-E-Y. Throughout, there are such problems with spelling, with punctuation. But listen to the spirit. Desdemona Fulmer. I want to write a short history of my life, the more particular part that I think will do the youth some good, and those that come into this church not having the same experience that I have had. I was brought up with goodly parents, or godly parents, yet with the ignorance of the Gentiles. I was taught to pray, being raised very strictly. When I was 13 years old, I prayed much in secret alone to the Lord. One night, I dreamt that I saw myself in a company of people moving into the wilderness that would live pure before the Lord. From that time, I became very serious of mind, not long after I received a change of heart. Then I began to read the Bible much and read the Bible much and all the different creeds of the churches to know what people I should join. I prayed much to know about it. One time I was praying, and I fell to the ground and lay for several hours as dead. There was a voice said to me, "Stop yet a little longer. There is something better for you yet." So I stopped, which means waited, till I heard the Latter-day Saints preach the gospel. I joined them soon after. I went into Kirtland with a few saints, and I lived 1 year there. During that time, a great number of the members turned against the church. Oliver Cowdery, with others, would say to me, "Are you such a fool as still to go to hear Joseph Smith, the fallen prophet?" I said, "The Lord convinced me he was a true prophet, and he has not told me that he is fallen yet." Women whose testimony was based on that sort of conviction, that sort of internal witness, had strength to handle the things that we deal with here at Sunstone. In fact, I think they would handle them with much more eagerness even than we do. Lucy Walker Smith, the one that I started with, continued her account a little bit further. "In the year 1842, President Joseph Smith sought an interview with me and said, 'I have a message for you. I have been commanded of God to take another wife, and you are the woman.' My astonishment knew no bounds." There isn't a one of us here at this conference or in this room who has not had to deal secondhand with the problem of polygamy. Here is a young woman having to deal with it initially. But listen to her words. "My astonishment knew no bounds. This announcement was indeed a thunderbolt to me. He asked me if I believed him to be a prophet of God. 'Most assuredly I do,' I replied. He fully explained to me the principle of plural or celestial marriage, said this principle was again to be restored for the benefit of the human family, that it would prove an everlasting blessing to my father's house and form a chain that could never be broken, worlds without end. 'And what have you to say?' he asked." Can you imagine the pause? "Nothing. How could I speak, or what could I say?" He said, "If you will pray sincerely for light and understanding in relation thereto, you shall receive a testimony of the correctness of this principle." I thought I prayed sincerely, but was so unwilling to consider the matter favorably that I fear I did not pray in faith for light. Gross darkness instead of light took possession of my mind. I was tempted and tortured beyond endurance until life was undesirable. Oh, that the grave would kindly receive me, that I might find rest on the bosom of my dear mother. Why should I be chosen from among thy daughters, Father? I'm only a child in years and experience. No mother to counsel, no father near to tell me what to do in this trying hour. Oh, let this bitter cup pass." And thus I prayed in the agony of my soul. And I wonder if in our own lives, what our equivalents to that challenge are, the things which would make us call into question the things that the prophet might say. I think there are many. "The prophet discerned my sorrow. He saw how unhappy I was and sought an opportunity of again speaking to me on this subject and said, 'Although I cannot under existing circumstances acknowledge you as my wife, the time is near when we will go beyond the Rocky Mountains, and there you will be acknowledged and honored as my wife.' He also said, 'This principle will yet be believed in and practiced by the righteous. I have no faltering words to offer. It is the command of God to you. I will give you until tomorrow to decide this matter. If you reject this message, the gate will be closed forever against you.'" I leave that in our souls to ponder. "This aroused every drop of scotch in my veins. For a few moments I stood fearless before him and looked him in the eye. I felt at this moment that I was called to place myself upon the altar, a living sacrifice, perhaps to brook the world in disgrace and incur the displeasure and contempt of my youthful companions, all my dreams of happiness blown to the four winds. This was too much. The thought was unbearable, for as yet no shadow had crossed my path aside from the death of my dear mother and sister. The future to me had seemed one bright cloudless day. I had been speechless. But at last I found utterance and said, "Although you are a prophet of God, you could not induce me to take a step of so great importance unless I knew that God approved my course. I would rather die. I have tried to pray, but received no comfort, no light. And emphatically, I forbade him speaking again to me on this subject. Every feeling of my soul revolted against it. Said I, the same God who sent this message is the being I have worshipped since my early childhood, and he must manifest his will to me." He walked across the room, returned and stood before me with the most beautiful expression of countenance and said, "God Almighty bless you. You shall have a manifestation of the will of God concerning you, a testimony that you can never deny. I will tell you what that shall be. It shall be the peace and joy that you never knew." How earnestly I prayed for these words to be fulfilled. It was nearly dawn after another sleepless night, while on my knees in fervent supplication, my room became filled with a holy influence. To me, it was in comparison like the brilliant sunshine bursting through the darkest cloud. The words of the prophet were indeed fulfilled. My soul was filled with a calm, sweet peace that I never knew. Supreme happiness took possession of my whole being, and I received a powerful and irresistible testimony of the truth of the marriage covenant called celestial or pearl marriage, which has been like an anchor to the soul through all the temptations of trial and trial of life. That kind of insistence upon spirit, insistence upon personal affirmation, and the demand, the wrestling with God for an answer, was the kind which persuaded also another of our foremothers, Eliza R. Snow, to accept the same invitation and become, as did Lucy Walker, a wife of Joseph Smith in plural marriage. I think Eliza brings us to a point, though, of what happens after. Like Lucy, Eliza could never be acknowledged as a wife. The year 1842, the same year in which Lucy Walker had accepted Joseph's proposal, Eliza was left alone in the city of Nauvoo. She had never married. She was 39 years old. Her sister Leonora, with whom she had been very close, was in Lima, 30 miles away, with her family. And Eliza had been brought to Nauvoo by the Rigdons. She was to teach school in Sydney Rigdon's children and in their home. The Rigdons and the Smiths parted company. Eliza's dear brother, Lorenzo, who was her kindred spirit, her soulmate, was on a mission to Britain. Her parents, in leaving Walnut Grove, left in bad spirit. Her father was antagonistic towards Joseph Smith and all the Mormons. Her mother, in the pattern of women in the 19th century, accepted her husband's jurisdiction and moved with him to Walnut Grove, several miles away. The Relief Society was organized, and one would hope that would give Eliza the sisterhood that she needed in the place of the family she had lost. It did, briefly. It began, and the blessings that flowed from woman to woman in that society could have filled the void. We're about to fill the void, but Relief Society itself became torn by dissension. Then, the moment when Eliza married Joseph on June 29th, 1842, 3 months after the beginning of Relief Society, and received from Emma Smith an invitation to come and live at the homestead with the Smith family. For Eliza, this must have been an affirmation of the reality of her relationship with Joseph. But when we read the history closely, Emma needed a babysitter. She wanted to go north with Joseph. And Eliza, having been governess to her children, seemed a logical candidate. So she brought Eliza into the home. 6 months it lasted. The biographers of the Emma biography and I together have realized that that was not a match made in heaven, that Emma and Eliza could never cohabit the same small house. There was strife, and Eliza, with a profound diary silence, left the homestead and moved to her good friends, the Holmeses. Joseph arranged for her the next year to live with the Markhams, who were probably even less kindred to Eliza's soul than Emma had been. And then the Relief Society was disbanded. 1844, June 27th, Joseph was killed, and Eliza must weep alone. Eliza must mourn unacknowledged, except by her brother Lorenzo, who had returned, and Elvira Holmes, who also was a wife to Joseph. Only these few people could know of Eliza's sorrow. But Lorenzo, at this point, married himself, 4 women. He had no time for Eliza. Bathsheba Smith described Eliza's room at the Markhams' household as one which sounds, those of you who know the literature would see Mrs. Dalloway in Virginia Woolf's novel saying, "My bed becomes ever narrower and whiter, more pristine." And in that room, Bathsheba tells us, in the attic at the Markhams' house, the white damask bedspread over a narrow bed, a small trunk, a table with a simple candle and the scriptures on it, Eliza wrote what she called an invocation. And if we read it as an invocation, and if we read it through Eliza's soul, it becomes not the plan of salvation lesson from the missionary program, and not a statement of Mormon doctrine. It becomes the prayer of a woman seeking her Lord, seeking the eternal family of which she knows she is a member, but from which she feels alienated, feels distant, feels a stranger here. We'll close this devotional by singing Eliza Snow's "O My Father." For those of us who don't know all the words, and I suspect most of us do, there are 1 or 2 copies around. We'll ask Bronwyn to come and play with us as we sing it. The last verse we'll sing without piano accompaniment, but just with Bronwyn. So when the piano stops, don't you stop. Let's sing then the "O My Father." And as you sing it, think in terms of the meaning to the soul of a woman seeking the Lord, and watch for that as we go through.